Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hi, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm your co-host, Jeannie Rice, and we welcome you to the show. Today's Aramaic Friday, and we have Dr. Dale. I'm going to give you that title anyway, Dale. I've done that a couple of times, but we welcome you to the show. This is Aramaic Friday with Dale Hoffman, and it is August the 15th, 2014. We are 1 week away from our final intensive here at Heartland, which is a 16-day Laws of Living that begins next Friday. So we've got a week off to try to catch up with ourselves a little bit and to get ready for the Laws of Living. Our calling number on the show here is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and your questions, because then that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Keep your heart, and welcome, Dale. It's a delight to have you with us. We're honored every time you come and join us. And my apology for last Friday. We were in the middle of the hands-on energy field work training when the show started, and Jeannie was the sample person, and she was just jumping in and out of so many skill points that I became totally absorbed and totally spaced out on the time. So my apology for that, and we're delighted that you're here. We're delighted for everybody that joined us. We're honored to have each of you join us. And if you want to touch into Dale Allen Hoffman's work, you can go to his website, daleallenhoffman.com. Jeannie and I were watching one of your videos last night, Dale, and it was fun to watch you in different stages of hair growth. Some of you shot there with that short hair and then that medium length hair. We didn't get any of the long hair, but it looked good.
I actually just
Jeannie has a compliment for you. She went totally unconscious and went to sleep. So,
I just cut it again a little. Actually, Jeannie told me you all weren't on the show last week because you were trying to get me back for the week before. I thought that's what you said. Now, speaking of my hair, I was just in New York City a couple of days ago, and we were in St. Patrick's Cathedral, and there was a young couple there, and I could hear, oh, my God, that guy looks just like Jesus. And then everybody starts looking at me. So it was funny.
Good shot. Well, do you have anything in mind to talk about today in particular?
Maybe traffic jams would be good. I'm sitting, Loretta's driving. I drove attempting to get through Washington, D.C., or get out of Washington, D.C., and we've been in traffic for many hours now. She's driving, at least, and I can just sit in the passenger seat and look out the window, but no, I don't have anything particular at the top of my mind today, at least.
Well, I just wrote a little one-page piece on forgiveness that is kind of designed to be a kind of thought of in the way of a puzzle, a little bit of a puzzle, not something that's just ABC straightforward, but hopefully triggers the mind into thinking. And so my thought was to share that and just get some of your thoughts on the ideas from it as relates to forgiveness from the first century Aramaic. So it'll be a poster that we'll be having available on our tape table. It's called "A Gift Is Forgiving." When forgiving cancels truth, only the shadow laid over truth by false perception injected from the past. Our present reality, the output of our minds, will forever influence our future actuality until we learn to forgive, until we learn to remove its distorting influences. We can only change our future to the extent that we exercise choice and receive our present. The present actuality always holds a gift for our future. As long as the non-being mind rules, we will never experience the true present, as the present actuality will be covered over and hidden by darkened perceptions from our past. To go to the next level, false forgiveness, the forgiveness of others, must stop. We must be willing to consistently, persistently practice actual forgiveness, removing the cloud of darkness laid over our perception by the past. This is how to change the future. The power to do this is called choice. The tool is forgiveness. You cannot change your future if your words and perceptions are based in active fear and or hostility, and you refuse to forgive the energy from your past, defiles your perception, and prevents you from experiencing this present moment, actuality, which always contains your gift.
Wow, is that the end?
That's the end.
Wow. Yeah, I love that I got the understanding of choice from you as opposed to decision. And it's funny how I went really digging into the Latin for a while and saw that the Latin prefix DE, the DE sound, means to move something apart from something else. And the sice sound, decise, sice means to cut into something, to cut it. So decision actually means to something apart and move it away from, you know, to basically cordon it off. And of course, decisions that, which is not conscious, it's that sort of remote process of the mind that just happens under the surface, and there's no real choice in decision. And it's amazing how I have such different outlook on choice than a lot of people sort of, I guess, lump choice and decision into the same category, and it's not quite the same thing, is it?
Oh, not even close. Until the mind can distinguish between those two, the tendency is to be stuck with the decision from the past, and, you know, as you say, it means to cut off, to decide. It's the same root as suicide, homicide, fratricide. Matricide means to cut off, to, you know, disassociate from. It's part of the disassociation process. And so once we understand that this multi-generational database called the body-mind unit has a decision as input for everything we'll ever experience, even things we haven't experienced before. You know, the person who has fear of things they haven't experienced before, there's a decision in the structure. Something shows up they haven't experienced before, the mind goes into fear. We could choose confidence, but if the decision, if what the generations have done is, uh-oh, something new, we're in trouble, uh-oh, something new, we're going to get hurt or damaged, then the decision is fear. And everything that we face, if someone has a prejudice, for instance, against, let's say, members of the opposite sex, then the decision will always prejudice into the mind's image of anyone of the opposite sex, and the mind just, the carbon-based memory system just keeps replicating that same old decision. And when we activate the spiritual faculty of choice, which I see as one of the five smooth stones of David, you know, the decision-making machine called the body-mind unit with its multi-generational database is Goliath. And, you know, anybody who's ever said, well, you know, in this circumstance, you know, whenever you, dear, said this to me, I've always gone into rage my whole life, and Now I realize that I am love, and therefore I am going to function lovingly. And you say that to somebody, and you really choose to do that. And if the stress is low, then your choice will prevail. But when the stress is up and the chips are down, you know, when that person you've committed to be loved with gives you the look, what happens to the choice to be loving? The decision from the past comes up, takes over, and here I am back in my old pattern. And so, to me, the pathway of chipping away at the old decision, the old behaviors, and removing them, which is forgiveness, use the word remove in place of forgive, is half of the work, and the other half is strengthening the spiritual faculties of choice. And that's how Goliath, who symbolically, you know, is this 9-foot, you know, monster that is unbeatable. He's got swords and shields and spears and helmets and armor, and nobody can defeat him. But with the 5 smooth stones, the subtle practiced faculties on the spiritual level, one of them being choice, we have the ability to take apart Goliath and actually make new choices rather than be forced, when the stress is up and the chips are down, into old decisions. So yeah, I think it's a really important distinction, a really important piece of the puzzle.
You know, we had a great conversation, Dr. Tim and I, last week while you and Jeannie were trying to diss the program. And, no, and yeah, we had a great conversation, though, about, about, like, he had said that some people were asking him, you know, why are you constantly doing the show? You're doing that show 5 days a week. You're doing all these support groups. You're just always talking about it. You present this through your practice. And, you know, he made such a beautiful, sort of laid it out in such a beautiful way that that's what happens. It's in the exercising. It's in the practice of it, of doing it over and over and over and over and over again. And you're always keeping it at the top of the mind so that when we do have those times when, as you say, the stress is up and the chips is down, you're not reverting back into some kind of old decision process that was locked in place when you were 4 years old, but rather you're making a conscious choice to go, I don't want to say for the high road necessarily, but, you know, move through consciously, remove the root so that you're not repeating that same process, of course. And I don't know if you ever heard this phrase before, but one of the phrases that I hear a lot is, why is this happening to me again? And I'm not sure if you've heard that before, Michael or Jeannie, but it's one of those things.
I heard it somewhere. Or actually, the way I've heard it most often is, why are they doing this to me again? Because, of course, it's all their fault. And don't you dare try to point out to me that I might have a fault. There's no way it's got anything to do with me. It's all their fault. And, of course, that language, just the slightest thought or the words that somebody else is the cause of something that's happening in my life or inside of me, we define as denial. And the impact of denial is that when I deny, when I say, no, it's his fault, it's her fault, it's their fault, then I have to dissociate from the part of me that creates this. And when somebody comes along that points it out to me, I'll get lost in Satan, which in Aramaic, the resistor, one who misleads, all of a sudden, when somebody says, well, you know, I noticed that you've done this 47 different times with 82 different people. Maybe you're involved. The mind goes, no, not me. It's their fault. And goes, so now they're in resistance. No, not me. Well, excuse me, you're the one who's doing it. No, not me. And then the mind goes into a story. We're misled. The deceiver takes over. No, let me tell you the story of what really happened. And so, and most people in the world live trapped in Satan, the resistor, and don't want to hear and don't want to look at the truth of what their words are showing them, what their lives are showing them. And, you know, the first level of handling our stuff, I think, is when we start to change the internal dynamic. Those experiences disappear from our external world, but until we've done the core work, it doesn't disappear from our words. And so that's the importance of, you know, Yeshua says the power of life and death is in our words, and when we start really owning and looking at our words, then our words show us the parts of our minds that otherwise we're hiding from. And it's such an important step in the process to open that space and let go of the resistor and just, let me take hold of that feedback and see if it fits. Of course, if I can take a hold of it and see if it fits and it doesn't, I throw it away. But if I instantly go into, no, not me, then, of course, I'm back in the resistor. I'm back in, literally, in the Aramaic sense, trapped in Satan. And I'm a house divided against myself, and, of course, that house can't stand because it's going to keep creating experiences based on the dissociated mind, the part that's hidden. And it's a big challenge of building the brain cells to make the shift from one state, the resistor, into that state of willingness and ownership and being able to gently confront myself, soften and let go of those things that I need to look at.
Well, yeah, I also, I'm slightly entertained when you lay that out with some, and what they're going to actually hear is, okay, so what you're saying is, I'm supposed to forget everything, all these horrible things that people have done to me, and I'm supposed to just drop it and cancel that and just walk on down the road so that they can beat on me again in some future day. And that, again, it goes right back into, you know, whatever it is that you're hearing, it's going to go through the filtration process. I spoke last week about a radio show I had done that was interesting, that I would say something, and then the host was recapping, and like 18 out of the 20 times that he was recapping what I said, it was almost 100% perfectly opposite of what it was that I had said. And then I would, you know, he would try to jump to another subject, and I'd be like, wait a second, we need to go back, because that's not what I said actually at all. You actually just said perfectly opposite of what I said, so I'd like to, you know, clear this up first. And, yeah, but he was constantly trying to pull it forward. Like, I actually asked him during one of the commercial breaks, I was like, I find it interesting that, you know, you ask me something and I'll spend 2 or 3 minutes really outlining it and really explaining it, and then you'll take 10 seconds to completely morph and flip opposite what I had said and then pull us into a new subject so that you can do the same thing. And I asked him during the break, I was like, you know, I'm not quite getting the point of this, but amazing, though. And what ended up happening was 2/3 of the way or so into the interview, I dropped my goal of needing to communicate because I realized he wasn't hearing it anyway. And instead, I was just being open in the moment. And it was amazing because it started to transition at that point and to open up. And I realized, you know, what I was saying, he wasn't hearing anyway. So funny how that works.
Well, I think Yeshua had such an awesome insight into the whole process of life. And at that point, he would have said probably, well, Dale, you know, unless he's got the eyes to see and the ears to hear, he can't hear it. And so, and I've had that, I had a peak experience of that. I've had that happen several times over the years, but I had a peak experience of that, oh, probably 20 years ago. I was up in Cape Cod at a center there presenting, and after I presented, the preacher got up and basically apologized for everything that I've said and turned it all backward rather than I'm responding, no, it's okay, it's their fault. And so I certainly identify and relate to that. And so one of the things that I've come to with this work is recognizing that my job is simply to put it out there. It's simply to make it available to people. What people do with it, it may take years for them to hear what was actually said because they're so stuck in their listening. You know, few people realize that listening comes from brain cells. And if what I say fires brain cells in somebody for the opposite of what I'm saying, because they're not willing to do their work, they're in denial, they're in dissociation, not willing to go there, then they're going to want to argue with and fight and turn it around. Because, you know, to me, one of the things that's really huge is to recognize that what with this work we're really asking people to do is we're literally asking them to open Pandora's box, which, you know, the Greeks told us, don't open Pandora's box because you never know what you're going to find in there. It's going to be terrible. And, you know, one of the things they didn't tell us when they told us that was if we never open Pandora's box, then our whole lives are going to start to look like Pandora's box. And we're going to wonder why this person does that to us, and, you know, our parents do this to us, and our spouses do that to us, and our children do that to us, and here we stand by as innocent victims, never willing to own the frequencies within us. And, you know, the words are such a key in the process. You know, Shakespeare, my words fly up, my thoughts remain below. And when I'm willing to just observe my words, they tell me about the content of my own dissociated mind. And that's such a huge gift to have. You know, we, as you know, in Heartland, we play the what we call the regulatory peace game, and we invite people into that game of being willing to receive feedback from each other on their speech. And when they're in their conscious of what they think they're saying one thing, but their unconscious is betraying them and they're saying the opposite, to become willing to receive the feedback of that opposite and to see, oh, there's where my creative process is going. I didn't realize that. Thank you. And being able to receive that feedback is such a gift, but a challenge at first for people. I know, you know, and again, we call it the regulatory peach game, and the reason we do that is because in our Laws of Living Intensive, which is starting next Friday, if anybody's ready to do the next level of their work, we spend several days talking about what we call regulatory speech, and that is the speech that regulates our physiology, our chemistry, our emotions, our perceptions, and our creative process. When we speak from an unconscious level, we have no idea that we're creating the opposite of what in our heads we think we're creating. You know, the person who says, well, I'm never angry. It's like, okay, so now would you be willing to look at your anger? Because your words say that in brain cells there's something about anger. And so when somebody can willingly go, oh, well, let me look at that, then they can embrace that part of themselves and throw it out. So we were doing an intensive, this goes back several years ago, there's a woman here with her son who was about 3 years of age, and they were on the floor at the Heart Center sitting on a blanket, and he's, you know, her son is sound asleep, and we're getting ready. We've been talking for 3 or 4 days about regulatory speech, and we're getting ready to take an intermission, so there's a little bit of noise, and this little 3-year-old Orion is, you know, starting now with the people starting to shuffle around the room, is starting to wake up, and someone had gone into the walk-in to get a bowl of peaches for a snack. And Orion looks over and, you know, rubbing his eyes, sees this big, huge, clear plastic bowl of peaches and whispers in his mom's ear, of course, loud enough for everybody in the room to hear it, Mom, are those regulatory peaches? So in honor of Orion, we call it the regulatory peach game. But at first, most people that step into and they say, oh, yeah, sure, I'm willing to play that game, they get to the point of like, you know, well, why don't you just shut up and just let me talk? I didn't mean that. That's not what it's like. Your conscious awareness didn't mean that, but your unconscious holds that. That's why you're using the words. And so to recognize that, instead of cutting off from that, instead of deciding, I'm going to cut that part of me off and I'm just going to speak from, you know, my conscious awareness, which is like the tiniest fragment compared to that unconscious data, which, you know, contains the decisions and behaviors of and the words of 1,000 generations. And until we can own that 1,000 generations, until we can consciously, purposely embrace that part of us, then we can't heal it. We can't forgive it. We can't remove it because we can't even see it. So it is an interesting process for somebody to build the brain cells to make that shift into a new place and not have to turn everything around, but just to be able to go, oh, cool, okay, I get that. Okay, I'm ready to work on that one. Pretty cool.
You know, that brings to mind the importance of coming into that realization that how much sense does it really make to live from the thoughts of a 4 or a 5-year-old? And I think of certain friends or even in myself in some situations, how, you know, they just seem like they've got a great handle on things. They're very successful, whatever it may be. Get in the presence of whatever a certain, that power person may be, whether it's a parent, uncle, brother, sister, and you can watch that cloud come over and you can see them revert back, almost like it's almost like going and watching someone who's in their whatever 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s that's in complete what appears to be complete control of life, and then all of a sudden absolute reversion back to looking at a 7-year-old and a relationship that's never grown in 30 or 40 or 50 years because they've never been able to, you know, have that realization of going in and removing the roots that they set in, those roots that they planted when they were 4 and 5 years old and weren't even conscious, to realize that in that relationship, or even in a relationship that even resonates those roots that were put down in there, they don't realize that a lot of times they're standing here in front of someone when they're in their 30s or 40s looking at that person, and they're not seeing that person. They're not even really seeing through their own clean or clear eyes. They're actually looking from the perspective of a 4-year-old at a parent or a sibling or whatever that may be. It's such a wild, amazing, exciting process to see. I saw that at Heartland in 95. As a matter of fact, if that was Orion, your child was a little blonde Orion. I remember him.
Yeah. Yep.
That was back then. I remember him.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, you're right on there with the person who hasn't dealt with their 4-year-old issues. You know, you watch Joe Businessman, who's, you know, as you say, this fully controlled adult and in charge of it all, and then the 4-year-old shows up and does a behavior that resonates what this seeming adult hasn't dealt with, and all of a sudden, we've got this raging 4-year-old in this 38-year-old body now beating up on a little kid because the kid resonated the brain cells. I remember a few years back, I was on an airplane, and sitting in the row right behind me, there was a mom and a mother and a father and a little kid, maybe two and a half, three years old. And it looked like he was probably on an airplane for the first time. And he was so excited. I mean, it was just, I could look between the crack in the seat to where he was sitting. And it was just so much fun to watch him. He couldn't sit still. He was just like a little on-go motor machines in excitement. And right next to me, in front of him, is Joe Businessman in his, you know, probably $1,000 suit, and he's Mr. Cool. And he's sitting there, and every time this kid's foot just touches his seat, the slightest touch, because the kid can't sit still, he's having fun, this guy's grip on the armrests of his seat gets tighter and tighter and tighter. And you can just see this guy going into deeper and deeper rage. And, you know, this is apparently an adult. But I can bet that at 3 or 4, when he became that excited, somebody smashed his excitement into the ground. And, you know, so we live in a culture that says children should be seen and suppressed. I mean, say it a little more nicely, we say children should be seen and not heard. But I think that's exactly the dynamic. And it was just interesting to watch this guy who was, I think, if it had gone on much longer and or if the parents hadn't been there, I mean, he literally could have gotten up and physically attacked this little kid. It's just amazing to watch. And you look at the amount of abuse that happens in our culture, and it's generational. It's passed from generation to generation of those who won't do their work and won't address, won't go back and look at those issues. And of course, when we're asking people to open Pandora's box and go back and look at those kind of issues, it's pretty heavy, meaty stuff. I mean, the child, the adult is going back and dealing with some really, really painful, generationally stored energies that, you know, need to be forgiven. And if we don't forgive them, as that story that I read, that post that I read in the beginning, then those old energies that are overlaid on our perception, distort our perception, and we think we're dealing with a present moment experience, but really we're not.
You know, I had a great day yesterday. I was able to go spend a few days with my father up in New Jersey. We went up to New York, spent, you know, time with different friends around New Jersey. But yesterday, before we left to get down to a friend of mine in Maryland, I was able to go and visit my Aunt Marie, who's 93 years old right now, 93 years young, I should say. And right across the street from her house was my grandmother's house, and right next door to that is the house I grew up in the first 10 years of my life. And it was really was profound for me yesterday to see my kids walking around and gathering stones and like little leaves and things like that. And Shemaya was digging in the dirt, and I'm looking at her, and it was like I'm flipping back and forth between looking at my, you know, my little girl, and somehow it's me. And my Aunt Marie asked me if I still had my big wheel, which was my little plastic sort of trike thing that I drove until the front wheel split in half. I told her, of course, I don't think I would fit on that if I did still have it. But I went out at one point, and I stood out next to the road while Shemaya was running in the grass, and I looked, and all of a sudden the thought popped in of getting, I was riding on my sister's handlebars on her bicycle, and I don't know how it happened. It was almost like the car came out of nowhere and popped us. And I went flying and landed on my head, passed out. When I came to, I was, you know, screaming, and it was, you know, just completely pain that I can, I can still remember the pain of it. But the thing that was so intriguing that I remember going back about 15 years ago, and I had a migraine. And, I mean, it wasn't just a normal migraine. It was one of those things that just flattens you out for days on end, and I started doing a worksheet about a migraine, and I ended up tracing it actually back to that, tracing it all the way, it wasn't actually, it was a series of worksheets, but I traced it back just in the first worksheet to being hit on the head when I was a kid, which was something that my sister's friends used to do. They, and my brother would do it, and my brother's friends would do it. They would just clobber me on the head with different things. And I ended up tracing it all the way back to being like 4 years old, riding on her handlebars, and somehow how I just kept repeating the pattern of that over and over and over again. I was so pissed off and angry at the guy that hit us. I almost felt like he was driving down the road just to find us and slam right into us. And it was amazing wow. how I locked that rage in just at the age of four. And then all of a sudden, without, of course, at that age, you don't think about it. It seemed like everybody was knocking me on the head for several years. And here I am. I was probably 30 years later with this intense, or it was probably about 20 years later, with this intense migraine. And after, it was about 12 sheets, I would say, worksheets or so, all of a sudden unlock, and there it was. And it was amazing because I'm standing there, and I sort of recalled the accident, and I was looking, and I started realizing that I had been having migraines for the last week or so, and I stood there, and I just kept breathing, and I kept breathing through it, and my head was a little bit tight then, and over the course of the next 5 minutes or so, that started clearing itself out, and I realized that there was still residue of that, even after some, I hadn't gone probably all the way maybe 15 years ago, and anyway, that tightness right. and all of the migraines went away, so it's amazing. There's choice in that. It's not just, I'm not a victim yep. to something in the past. I'm not a victim to a migraine. There's actually choice there, which is something that, yeah, like you say, you can say that to some people, tell them, you know, that's something that's at a level of choice, and they can't even hear that. They're like, no, no, how can you possibly say that you attracted this or that there's any kind of a choice in this? You know, this is, we're a victim of it. We've got to deal with it, and we just shut up and, you know, walk along the road. And wow.
Now, the willingness to do our work is such a big piece of the puzzle. And, you know, when you faced that 15 years ago, chances are you were not at the vitality level that you are today, and that's why just recently you were able to go to a new level of clearing that energy out of your structure and ridding yourself of that. I know 3 years ago we had a young woman at one of our intensives here at Heartland, and the first 3 days of the intensive, she sat with a bucket, and she had a migraine headache, and she would literally be sick every 10 minutes. And from the first minute when that started for her, I asked her when she had migraines in her life, and she was like, I've never had migraines, never had migraines, never had migraines. When was the last time? Never had migraines. She literally sat there in a migraine and being sick in this bucket, I mean, so often, she stuck with it. She hung with it. And finally, I asked one more time, and all of a sudden, she was like, oh, my God. And she had worked in the gaming industry in Las Vegas as a high-level executive with one of the gaming corporations, high pressure, high stress, literally working 18 hours a day while she had two babies at home. And when she broke through and finally came to her awareness,
oh my God, I had migraines every day for 10 years while I worked in the gaming industry. Every day. And for 3 days, she had no recollection that she'd ever had a migraine. And then once she allowed that memory to surface, she put the bucket down, that was the end of the migraines. I mean, totally, completely, 100% gone. But that denial system is so powerful and can keep things hidden on such a deep level. It's just amazing. And that's another reason why, if we pay attention to our words, when otherwise it might take years to get to it, attention to our words, then our words will tell us what's going on in that level, and then we can, you know, use the tools to open and embrace that part of the mind and let go of it rather than, oh, no, it's too painful for me to go in there and look at it. It's just, you know, it opens stuff at a whole new level.
Wow.
And we've got a caller. I think it's Mark Hattis. So, Mark, Jeannie has just opened your microphone. Welcome.
Well, hey, both of you. Dale, I met you once. This is Mark. I saw you at Tim's event in Woodstock. Pleasure to be on with you and, of course, with you, Michael. I am...
Absolutely. Beautiful.
I am sitting here looking at a cross that's up in the sky at a steeple. And I thought, you know what? I wonder why they did that. I wonder why they put the crosses so high. And I was wondering, Dale, or Michael, is there something in the Aramaic language that describes the true nature of what that cross represents instead of what we've been taught it represents? Is there
something that's
kind of an insight there?
I was going to say that it is not necessarily anything specifically in Aramaic, but the cross, that cross that we look at as Christian, it's not Christian in any way. It's actually, although there's some Sumerian and Phoenician sort of influence in that, it's mostly an Egyptian idea, and it's a combination of what you could call the hero's journey, which I'll talk about, and also it's cosmic. The cross was, of course, the southern, a lot of people don't realize, the southern crux. Well, actually, let me talk first about what was called the hero's journey. The up and the down, in other words, you know, the vertical part of the cross, the longest part of the cross, represented our eternal nature. It represented the truth with a capital T that we are not created and we do not die. We are one with all that exists. There's nothing more to become, that we already are everything. And then the cross that goes across was a representation of the human self, which was seeking to become more, seeking to grow, to become, you know, a greater awareness of with God, etc. And then at the crux, or at the cross point, the word excruciate actually comes from the Latin root that means at the cross point. And excruciate means to be crucified on the cross, which has nothing to do with Jesus, long before him by thousands of years. What it actually meant was that place where we suffer, where the hostility and the fear reside, where it's the difference between the truth that we are, what we are looking for, you know, in the words of St. Francis, versus the realities that we pile up, all of the bushel baskets that we pile up, and right there at the cross point between our eternal nature and us trying to become something we already are, we suffer at the cross point. And,
what I wanted to talk to you about. That's the point. I'm glad you said that. And I know I've never heard that before. I'm glad you said it because of this. This is the question that I think was really on my mind. And I couldn't get at it without your explanation. So I apologize for interrupting, first of all. When you're at the cross point, when you're at the point where you're about to hit the cross point, or hit that point in your life where you're dying from something other than a physical death, but really a spiritual death, and then anticipation of the resurrection, or Yeah. Is the resurrection represented in the cross, or is that something that we just kind of made what it is after the actual resurrection?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I would also say this, too. A lot of people don't realize the astrotheological basis of where the actual the Christmas and the cross and the crucifixion sequence comes from. It's not Christian in any way, actually. It's Egyptian, again. And it goes back to Horus. Horus was the sun god. His father was Osiris. His mother was the virgin Isis Mary. We're going back about 3,000 B.C., about 3,000 years before the lifetime of Yeshua. And one of the things that actually happens that a lot of people don't realize is that at winter solstice, around the time of winter solstice each year, on the 21st of December, people don't realize that what was called the only begotten Son, S-U-N, not S-O-N, of God, which is our sun in the sky, which was also known as Ra in the Egyptian cultures, the sun would come down, and Horus was also a representation. The sun would, from the perspective of Earth, fall down into the center of the region of what's called the cross, or the southern cross, the southern crux in the sky. So it actually looked like the only begotten Son of God would set on that cross. Happens every year, every single year, from the perspective of Earth, that the sun dies on the cross, right in the middle of the southern cross, and it sits there for 3 days. Now, late on the 24th and early on the 22nd, our perspective of the constellation of Orion begins to shift. And what happens is the three kings, which are on Orion's belt, the three kings of Orion's belt, point at and line up. They follow the star in the east, which is, of course, Sirius, which is in Orion's leg. The three kings point at Sirius, the star in the east, to locate the newborn sun. The three kings point directly at Sirius, which points directly at the sun, which now rises 1 degree from the perception of Earth on the morning of December 25th, Christmas morning. The sun moves 1 degree north from the perspective of Earth, so that the only begotten Son, S-U-N, that had died on the cross for 3 days, now arises on the Christmas morning to be, as they would call back then, to become born again or resurrected. It was completely astrotheological, and it was also completely Egyptian, and was just adopted by the Christians. It took several hundred years
that
for that
must
to
be
fully brought in. So
that must be why I was in Israel, and I went to a church in one of the outskirts. It wasn't in Jerusalem. It was sort of in one of the camps or cities that was outside. And inside the church, the guy who was our guide, he was like an ancient guy. He'd been around for a long time, knew a lot of stuff, and he was one of those where you listen to him and you just think, okay, this guy knows what he's talking about. And we got into this one church, and it was the only one I saw, because we went to a lot of the churches, it was the only one that saw who had an astrological zodiac kind of thing in the church floor, in the mosaic on the floor. And you could still see it. It was a little, you know, so I wonder if they knew, do we know as that one that we are, that that's really the connection point, and that's what we're trying to get back to, is kind of that truth that was really there, and this is just a story that the church uses to help us see it.
It was very common knowledge. As a matter of fact, if you look at most of the astrotheological symbols, Jesus is wearing, of course, a crown of thorns, which are the sun rays. That crown of thorns is also the glow of the sun when it's at the center of the cross. It's that glow. It's the halo of the only begotten on the cross. And also, in addition, of course, if you look at the really early pre-Catholic Christian artwork, he's surrounded by the 12 houses, which is the 12 tribes of Judah, which is the 12 disciples, which, of course, is the 12, it's the zodiac. It's the zodiac calendar. So you'll see Yeshua with his head in the center of the zodiac calendar with the cross surrounded by the concentric circles and, of course, surrounded by either the 12 constellations or the 12 disciples or the 12 tribes of Judah. And in some art, you'll see all three layers of those in there. And, of course, he was teaching in the temple, which means the energy, the embodiment of energy, the sanctuary, at the age of 12. You know, there's symbology to all of this. And, yeah, there's so many layers to it. And it was something that, and it's really not hard to find if you just research it. It wasn't really something that was hidden from our view. It was just that it was just kind of not talked about for a long time. The Roman Catholic Church was actually quite open in the beginning, and you'll find it in a lot of the earliest writings, that they chose to adopt a lot of the Egyptian and some of the Greek ideas of the gods and the only begotten Son of God and Horus and Mithra and Dionysus and Osiris, because they knew that that's what most people believed. They believed in the paganism. They believed in the fertility festival known as, that we now call Easter. They believed in the winter solstice and the turning of the world, or the Yule, which means wheel. And Galilee actually also means wheel or hoop. And they actually were very open in the beginning, at least, the Catholic Church, that they were going to adopt a lot of those mythic ideas and lay those over top of the Jesus story, because they knew that would be the way to most effectively get people to buy into it and stay with it, and it ended up actually working. But after a while, they stopped talking about the overlays, and they just talked about it as if it was factual as a story itself, which, you know, it, of course it's not. So,
what if something told you, like an insight, and I know, Dale, you get a lot of these insights. I heard you talk in front of Tim's group, and I thought, wow, this guy sounds like he's just talking from a place that's just really knowing. And it was just a confidence. It wasn't a confidence like you studied in a book, although I know you've studied. It was a confidence like you just had this knowing. And I heard it on the call today as you're talking about the cross and the vertical and the horizontal and that, you know, middle point and the Egyptians and everything. I'm just like in awe that, wow, this guy really has it going on. And I have another question, and it's a little different. But it's a question about...
Before you move to the other question, I'd like to just throw in a thought around the idea of the cross. Constantinian, pre-3rd century, the symbols that were used by what was called the Christian community were symbols of life. They were bread, fish. They were symbols of aliveness and life and sustenance. Constantine came in, and he had this, you know, he was a warrior, and he's trying to figure out, how do we get these Christians that know how to do their work and therefore we can't control them? How do we get them back into the unconsciousness so they follow and do what we tell them to do? And he tells everybody how he had this vision of this, you know, sword, and, you know, he was going to go wipe out the bad guys on the planet, and that it was being done for Christ. And the cross is the symbol that was injected then, and now a symbol, as it's often used, to keep people in fear and suffering. You know, it is also the worst instrument of torture that anybody has ever invented, and the Romans used it very effectively to keep people under control. And so there's the negative aspect of that symbol, the way it's been used to keep people thinking about the suffering and the pain, and, you know, I mean, you think about the stations of the cross. What are you supposed to do? You're supposed to bow in and to the suffering and accept the suffering, which certainly the man who it's supposedly that story told about said, I come to bring you life and bring it more abundantly, not suffering. They knew pre-Constantinian, then Constantine came in with this symbol of the cross and turn people's minds to suffering instead of the truth behind that whole symbology.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%.
They answered my question, Michael.
Oh, cool. What fun.
What's that?
What fun.
Well, sometimes I guess you just have an insight that is right on everybody's mind, so I'm sure I'm not the only one that had the question. So thanks for answering.
Cool. Delighted.
Next time
delighted
you have
to
wait
to play with you and have your input.
Just kidding. Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate you guys. I'll sign off.
Okay. Blessings. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Do we have any other callers? Anything happening in the chat room?
Earlier, when you were reading the thing about the giving,
including the I am in it, and that we forget who the I am is. And it made me think about the movie we watched the other night. And so then I was giving them the link to that. And so some of the chat was about who the I am is.
Right. The I am that I am. Maybe you want to address that, Dale, from your the Aramaic insight.
Well, you know, there's two different sort of two things that kind of get lumped together. One would be Moses speaking to that burning bush back in Exodus, and he says, you know, who shall I say sent me, basically asking for the name of God. And he heard back, you know, in that great Charlton Heston-type voice or whoever it was, which you usually hear translated as I am that I am, and some will really stick on that translation and say that's the only way to translate it. But unfortunately, it can be translated thousands of ways, like I shall be that I shall be, I am becoming that I am becoming. I love, some will say I am that, comma, I am that, I am. But, you know, if you look at the I am in a lot of the Jesus teachings, I've talked about it a lot on here before, when you hear, like, I am the way and the truth and the life, I am the light of the world, I am the bread of life, I am the gate, which is tareia, which means portal or doorway, or the opening, the open space, that word that was translated as I am, actually it's two words, which is ina, ina. And ina alone by itself is a masculine-gendered word that is talking about a person, meaning if Jesus was talking about himself, you know, I, Jesus, I'm going to walk to the other side of the room, he would say the word ina, which was masculine, which would be meaning that he's talking about a physical person or an apparently physical person such as himself. I, Jesus, am going to walk to the other side of the room. However, in all of those I am statements in the Gospel of John and in many of the places, such as when he's at the well and the woman says, Mary, she says that she's waiting for the Messiah. And, of course, you see in the King James, it says, it is I that is speaking with you. And the funny thing about that is it doesn't say it is I at all, actually. It says ina, ina. Now, when you have one ina alone, it means I, Dale, the physical person, I, Jesus. When you have two inas together, one simply means I. Two of them actually means, which is what was translated as I am, it actually means the I within the I, or the I inside of the I, or the I behind the I. And then, of course, this actual inanna is the way we pronounce that when there's two of them, is a feminine word, which means we're not talking about a physical person anymore. We're talking about our highest light. We're talking about the light below the bushel baskets. And when he says, you know, I am the way and the truth and the life, and I am the bread of life, he's not talking about himself in any way whatsoever in Aramaic. He's literally speaking from the source and the witness or the eye behind the eye within the eye, which, of course, is what essentially what Moses is hearing. You know, I am that I am. I am the eye within the eye. That's not the bushel baskets piled on top of the lamp. Basically, I am the lamp itself. And like I always say from St. Francis, what you are looking for is what is looking. That which you seek is that which is seeking through you, and that's the eye within the eye. And I believe that that's the open door, that's the portal, that's the doorway where the veil lays over in the temple. And I believe that the access point to that, of course, is rahma. It's that state of being absolutely in the moment and allowing whatever's in that doorway or that portal, whatever veil or bushel basket may be blocking it, you're allowing that to burn up in that natural light because the veils aren't actually real anyway. It's, again, it's like Mike would say, it's the digital programming that we plant in there from past experience and then shade our present moment experience to such an extent that we're not even experiencing the present moment anymore. We're not experiencing the light within the eye within the eye, or the light within the light, or rahma, we end up experiencing the hostility and the fear. And that's what he's saying. He wasn't talking about himself as I am so much as the eye within the eye, which the center of my eye is the center of his eye, which is the center of all eyes. So it's quite beautiful.
Cool. Well, you know, that piece about where he says, I've opened the door wide, which no one can close. When you look at the piece of work that he did and, you know, why is he above most of the other, you know, the other prophets and such, is that he did a piece of work that nobody else was capable of achieving. You know, he's teaching us about eternal life. He's teaching us abundant. He says, abundance, I come to bring you life and bring it more abundantly. And if you overcome that non-being self, then you will enter into a new level of living. And, of course, they're all standing around going, what? What are you talking about? What does that mean? Or what does that mean? You know, you look at, here are 12 disciples, 11 of them, when the stress is up and the chips are down, deny him and run in the other direction. You know, Peter actually curses him and denies him. So they didn't get it. They didn't understand it. But in the whole suffering aspect of it, and so many people stand around and look at it and worship and oh, well, I want to suffer with him. That's the pathway. But what he did was he, in essence, said, okay, guys, I've been telling you this for so long. If you live as the I am, as the center of your being, as the active presence of love that you were created to be, then everything in your life will be transformed. So now that I've been telling you and you still haven't heard me, you still don't have the brain cells, watch. I'm going to go through the worst experience. I'm going to go through the most traumatic thing that anybody could imagine. And I'm going to come out the other side unscathed. Now do you get it? I have conquered death. I have, many people look at the suffering aspect of it and the message is limited to that. And they go, well, he walked out of the Garden of Gethsemane and he goes to that high priest and the high priest just takes him away. And, why didn't he bat that high priest in the head and beat him up? And, instead of healing him, why didn't he just beat on him like everybody else does? Because he was teaching that there was another level to live from and another level to express from, and that would change everything in you. So he goes through this experience with the high priest who's going to have his body shred to pieces. Peter comes in with the sword. He's going to play the hero, and he's going to off the high priest servant's head. Yeshua stops Peter, and he warns him what it means to live instead of from the I am, to live from the sword. He says, Peter, if you live from the sword, you'll die from the sword. That's the only reason he gave permission for Peter to bring a sword to the whole event, was to give us that lesson. And God, if we could only get that lesson, that if we live by the sword, the weapon, then that's exactly what we're sowing in the field, and we're going to get it back. So after Peter whacks off his ear, instead of, railing on the high priest servant, he goes over and he offers him healing. He reattaches, he heals his ear. And I've had people who say, well, gee, Michael, did you notice that doing that got him dead? That looks crazy. Look what he did. They killed him. And I said, yes, I noticed that doing that got him dead. Did you notice they couldn't keep him that way? That's what he really came to teach us, and that's the door that he opened that nobody can close. One person went through that gateway and stepped into the restructuring of his energy system, which we call the body, and did away with all of the old beliefs about physicality and death. But most people are still sticking around in the mindset of physicality and death. Even the physicists know better. When Einstein says there is no matter, the physicists are still looking for material cause, and they haven't caught up with Yeshua, and he gave us a message, and the message was, if you live from the I am of the I am, then you step into eternal life, and if somebody shreds your body, you'll rebuild it, and you'll step out, and there'll be a whole new game, and we're here to support everybody on the planet playing that whole new game. You can get more of Dale's work at DaleAllenHoffman.com. Of course, why is this happening to me again at whyagain.com. Come join us tomorrow or Monday. Bring a stranger with you and give the world the best gift you can. Live from the I am and create the best year yet of your eternal life. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com. AIN.com.